Okay. Oh yeah.
So this is continuing with Menzel on 18th August 76.
Well, so, I at that time I did not have any assistant in radio astronomy, but I had a background of electronics to know what the basic problems were, and I needed a receiver, which we called a swept frequency receiver.
Mm-hmm.
Well, through my connections with U.S. Navy, I knew of such things which were being used for some classified work, and I went a company that was controlled by Fubini, Gene Fubini, F-U-B-I-N-I, once at one time, or later than that, he became Assistant Secretary of the Navy, I
think.
Or maybe he was Secretary of the Air Force, but at least he had a company out in Long Island. Can't remember the name, but something, the Radio and Laboratory, IRL or something,
mm-hmm.
Didn't sound quite right. But I found out that they were the ones who manufactured this particular receiver for the
for
the Navy in Signal Corps. I took it up again through channels, through my connections with the chiefs of staff, and got the darn thing declassified, so that I could use it.
Right.
And then it was an ideal off the shelf. I do not like to try to design and build my own things. I always try to get the engineers to do the work. And so this was a case in point.
Now, how was this different from Wilde's spectrograph, or was it similar?
I have no idea, because it was developed entirely independently from Wilde.
I see. But you must have known about his work.
Well, I knew about it, but I didn't know the details of his equipment.
But you knew about the different type of bursts that were being found and this sort of thing.
Oh, yes. Yeah, this was...
It was clear that you wanted something like a swept frequency receiver.
That's right, and then I designed the television-type recording for it, which would give you time and frequency and intensity with brightness.
Mm-hmm.
And then I had been looking all this time to try to find somebody who would take over this station, and finally found an extremely highly qualified person by the name of Alan Maxwell.
And this was about when?
I would guess this was in 52.
Well, that early, is he? Well,
53?
I've talked to him, but I can't remember. Yeah.
Well, I'm...
So you never actually got involved with the observations yourself at Fort Davis? Set it all up and gave it to Maxwell.
That's essentially it. And he did all the job of setting it up, putting the equipment together.
Right.
And it worked very well.
Were you involved at all in those early years in the interpretation of the data that was coming from Fort Davis? Or?
Well, I was not to any great extent. I was aware of it, and I encouraged Maxwell in the work. I was trying simply to build up radio astronomy in all the different areas of radio astronomy in the United States.
Let me just ask, I'm not certain when you became director of Harvard Observatory. When did that happen?
Dr. Shapley retired in 1952, and I was appointed acting director in his place. And I was appointed director in 54.
I see. So that you had a lot to say in what Harvard was doing.
Oh, yeah.
Let me ask another general question about the reception that radio astronomy received from optical astronomers in general there are only a few cases like yourself and Bart Bach and Ort and so forth, people that really latched on to this new science, it seems to me. Can you comment on that?
Yes, I can. Bart was very much interested in it. He was interested in it before I was, effectively. I mean, actually doing observations. And now I can certainly put a date in here, because this was under Shapley's regime. And in 1950, I would say, we decided that Bart should have a radio telescope. And I don't know whether one should, just how much of this should go on the record, but it's
well,
kind of
amusing. Well, this is purely confidential.
It's an amusing thing. It's an amusing item, and rather typical Shapley, that Shapley never would spend a dime on engineering. And I was just the reverse.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to spend the money on the engineering before we built the equipment. And as a result, most of the equipment that Shapley designed never really worked. But we came out there. Shapley said he had a mounting, a telescope mounting there for an optical telescope, which we could use for a 20-foot dish, or maybe a 15-foot dish. I've forgotten. It was a small dish for radio astronomy. And when we got out there and saw this little flimsy thing, it wouldn't have held a 300 or 400 pounds, let alone a couple of tons of equipment at least. And both Whipple and I just about died laughing. Bart did not have any great deal of feeling for instrumentation as such, or engineering. But Shapley was furious with Whipple and myself, and accused us of trying to put Bach down and not supporting Bach.
I see.
Which was not true at all. In fact, as a follow-up to that, Whipple, and when some finances were being made in a small way for radio astronomy in the government, Whipple was one of the people to speak up for Bach, and we finally got, I think it was a 25-foot dish out at the Agassiz station.
Right.
And this was done on because of Whipple's and my activity, rather than not because of Shapley or Bach.
Right.
But the all of this time, I was becoming more and more concerned about the tardiness of development of radio astronomy in the United States. And I guess this must have been in the early 50s, I would say 52 or 53, because I probably was in the role of acting director. I got the idea, put it up to Bach and the others and the group, that we should join with MIT and build a large radio telescope somewhere in the Northeast. And I went down and talked with my old friend Jerry Wiesner, now, as you know, the president of MIT.
What was his position then?
Well, I think he was dean or something or other. I'm not quite sure.
Oh, I see. I thought you went down to Washington, D.C. You went to MIT.
MIT.
Right.
And we started making plans, and the plans grew and grew and grew. Wiesner was very enthusiastic about it. But I suddenly occurred to me, and I went down and had a talk with Jerry, and we both agreed that the plans had grown to a size that was greater than could be handled by both Harvard and MIT.
Mm-hmm.
And we decided we should make it a national facility.
About when was this?
I was just in the early 50s. I'm sure that the records will show this of the NRAO, because this was the beginning of the NRAO.
Which records are you referring to, though?
NRAO records.
You mean their early files?
Their early files, yes. Yeah. The first meeting was held, if I had to put a date on it, I would say 53. And the question was to get an organization behind this that would do the work of organization, building, handling funds from the government, and so on.
Right.
And I, after discussing this with Harvard authorities, we decided that the group known as Associated Universities, you know, the AUI,
right.
And
which was already running Brookhaven.
Which was already running Brookhaven. And Lloyd Berkner was president. And I went down and I talked it over with Lloyd, and he thought this was a very good activity. And we called the first meeting, which led to the formation of NRAO at the AUI offices in the Empire State Building in New York City. And we invited all of the radio astronomers we could think of. There weren't more than 8 or 10 of them that came. That was John Hagen and Krauss and of course Bach and myself. I counted myself as a radio astronomer in part because of my work on the sun. And so I... we agreed.
Merle too, but
Merle
was there.
Merle was there, but he was very antagonistic. Merle did not like Lloyd Berkner, and he just about blew up when we went with the UI, and he couldn't do much about it. He didn't have any alternative to offer.
Now, were there any other people that were thinking about this time of a national observatory was needed?
I don't think so. I think the idea was mine.
Mm-hmm. I've heard it said, I can't remember who, that NRL and DTM both decided, well, this would be a good thing to have one, and therefore they wanted to have it mainly for them, and so they had it in West Virginia.
That's how it got to West Virginia, and against my... I wanted to move it down to the Southwest.
Which is a better site, of course.
Well, much better. But there were the NRL group that was there, and of course the DTM. And they, of course, wanted it within practically within walking distance of Washington. And so we finally compromised and got, which I think is a reasonably good location.
Yes, for the East, it's about as good as you can do.
Yeah. We did make a careful survey, and out of this came the NRAO, and I was chairman of the board that ran it. I was chairman for 7 years.
Hmm. Now, were there a series of meetings, and I guess over several years, as the concept developed and
forth? Oh, yes, and then we had many meetings down at Green Bank.
Once that was picked, yeah.
Once that was picked, yes.
Now, the concept of a national observatory, this was something new, really, wasn't it?
It was, yes.
And what was the idea then, as it is now, namely that people would send in proposals from universities? And
yes.
Once again, I guess, modeled on Brookhaven.
It was to be modeled on Brookhaven.
Right. So the concept was known in physics, I guess, but not in astronomy.
Not in astronomy. I think that was... more or less the beginning of the NRAO, and the record should show that is the way it developed.
Well, Emerson wrote an article in Science about the beginnings of NRAO and so forth. Do you remember this at all? It was about 10 years ago. And I was just going to ask you if you thought that was an accurate...
I can't recall.
I can't remember quite what it said myself.
This was Dick Emerson?
Yes, he wrote it.
Oh, no.
Science 65, roughly.
Yeah. I'll have to look it up to see.
I can give you the exact reference tomorrow.
Okay.
I have that at home. I've jotted down a couple other questions.
Okay.
Why was radio astronomy, it seems to me, not really accepted by optical astronomy as a whole until the late 50s or so? Was it just because the techniques were so strange that...
I think it was, and I think that they just couldn't believe that you could do anything with something other than light waves.
So it was just a narrowness of... I mean, that's one way one could say it anyway, of outlook, is that what you're saying?
I think so.
And about the discovery of the hydrogen line, which of course was made by Ewan and Purcell at Harvard.
Yeah.
Was that sort of a completely independent thing from everything you've been talking about?
It was independent. It was done in the physics department.
Right. Now, I had not talked to either of those. I definitely want to, but do you know where they came up with this idea at all? I guess it was
Purcell
that had the idea.
Earl, Vanderhelt.
Vanderhelt made the prediction.
He made the prediction.
Right.
And so it became known, and they decided it was a good thing to do. I know they talked to Bach about it. They did not talk to me.
Hmm.
And so this was, 50?
51 was the discovery.
Okay, well,
and they were working
too far off.
Right. Let's see, we haven't mentioned the paper that you and Salisbury published in 48.
Oh, yes.
Could you just tell me what your idea was there?
Well, a little hard to recall all of the details, but I had, through my classified work, had come to have knowledge of that there were some peculiar, very peculiar signals in a very long wave range. And Salisbury and I put some of this information together and decided that that this was something that could be that might be worked out.
Meaning that that perhaps these peculiar signals came from the sun, was that?
Well, it was from the sun or from somewhere in space. I can't remember exactly what we said.
Well, the sun. The abstract here says that you thought that they came from active sunspots.
Active sunspots, yes.
So that's similar to your 1920s manuscript,
right.
Yes, really.
That's right. Yeah.
Except
that's
I guess
correct,
you were.
Yes, that's right.
But here you were thinking of very long. Very low frequencies.
Yes, we were, and we were thinking of them in terms of the development of cosmic radiation, which, again, solar cosmic radiation had not been recognized at that time, so again we were being somewhat ahead of...
Mm-hmm. But now, in this article, I don't believe that you mentioned, probably because it was classified, the motivation for
no.
How you gotten onto this.
No, I didn't mention the motivation. Classification was a... was a headache.
Right. And these peculiar signals, are they understood now? I mean, scientifically, as to what their origin is?
I don't know.
Or are they still a mystery, as far as you know?
I don't know.
Okay, the next reference I have here is that you wrote a paper with Crowley in Nature, suggesting that radio sources might be giant long-period comets which absorb the solar X-ray and ultraviolet. And
wait a second, you said Crowley?
That's what I had written down here in Nature in 1950.
Oh, no, just a minute. Crowley. That name didn't... I remember writing that paper, but somehow or other I would have... Oh, I'm trying to put the name... the name is completely knocked out. Oh Lord, there's somebody from the Air Force. Air Force Cambridge.
Crowley.
The name Crowley sounds familiar, but it didn't fit in with that.
Well, anyway, can you tell me how you came up with this idea?
Well, it's... No, I can't. It just was one thing that...
The radio sources, of course, were really puzzles then. I mean,
yeah.
There were only a few of them around.
That's right, and we didn't know whether they moved or not.
Right.
And
so it was just a speculative suggestion.
It was a speculative suggestion. It wasn't very important.
Okay. Next reference I have here is that at an Italian meeting in 1952, you talked about radio bursts as plasma oscillations.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I think other people had suggested this a few years before then, right? Was this the general feeling at that time that they were plasma oscillations, or was this just one of many possible mechanisms?
I suppose it's just one of a number of possible mechanisms, but it was one that particularly appealed to me, and I was working at that time in the field of magneto hydrodynamics.
Why did it appeal to you?
Well, because I do the mathematical physics that would be involved in the presentation, in the production of such things, so I felt it was at least something worthwhile considering.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know that I felt that I established it.
I also have here that you went to the Jodrell Bank Symposium in 1955, which was one of the earliest radio astronomy meetings. Can you remember anything about the atmosphere at that meeting? You were one of the few optical astronomers there, probably.
Yeah, I think that's true.
What struck you as being the exciting things that were going on?
I cannot recall. I'm sorry. It's just... It's hard to separate these different things. I've been to so many meetings.
Right.
And...
Well, if there's nothing...
I'm trying to think. I have a vague recollection. Was Paul Wilde at that meeting?
Probably was.
I think
yeah.
so. And I have a vague recollection of being very much impressed with Paul Wilde.
Right. Of course, you had a lot in common with your...
Oh, yeah.
Both having the spectrographs and so forth. Now, there's a paper in 56, a Harvard report, in which you and Warwick and Lawrence describe this dynamic spectrum analyzer.
Oh, yeah.
Now, were these engineers that were helping you?
Warwick, no. Well,
this is the Warwick that still is in radio astronomy.
Yeah, that's right. And it was he was just a graduate student then.
Mm-hmm.
And so was Lawrence, just a graduate student. I don't know whatever became of him, but Warwick is... to say he's still a boulder in radio astronomy.
Right. And finally we come to the meeting in 1958 at Harvard, sponsored by the Signal Corps, called the Radio Noise Spectrum.
Oh, yeah.
I assume you organized...
I organized that.
And what was the goal of it? What was the goal of this meeting?
Well, the basic reason it was organized was to try to get some order into this and some interest in the general problems. And it was, there were classified elements, as I guess you can now appreciate, behind it, because some of the money that came to us came from classified sources.
So the publication which you edited did not contain all of the, well, we're not at the meeting, is what you're
well,
saying?
Well, no, I didn't, I'm not saying that. I'm simply saying that some of the basic objectives were simply to put things together into a into an organized way so that those who are interested in the classified areas could
use it as a handbook sort of thing.
It's sort of a handbook, yeah.
Yeah.
And that was why we put it together.
Although there were a lot of people there that were, for many other different reasons.
Oh, yes.
Right.
Most of them didn't know about this classified aspect.
Well, I'm sort of ending things in the early 60s. Is there any other comments of things that we haven't covered that you'd like to make?
Mm. know, I still have regretted that Greenbank was put so close to Washington.
Right.
But
well, now, of course, it is shifting to the VLA is ultimately going to take over NREO, I think.
Yeah.
So it's after 30 years, your choice wins out. Well, thank you very much.
Well, it's been very nice.
That ends the interview with Donald Menzel on 18th August, 76.